Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show. This is your Tuesday Morning Show host, Julie Calamine, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Huff. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, Julie. How are you doing?
Really great.
How was the weekend? Anything fun and exciting?
Well, it was busy, and it was also fun and exciting. And the reason it was fun and exciting is that I needed to renew my wilderness first aid training, which I did over the weekend.
That's great. So we can go hiking together again.
We can, and I can keep an eye on you if you do something crazy.
Ah, I'm relieved.
That was offered through Friends of Scotchman Peak Wilderness, and I'm very appreciative that they offered it so that we can all be trained and ready if something does happen that needs first aid out in the wilderness.
Yeah, I think really one of the most important things that training teaches is how necessary it is to make safe decisions, how limited really the resources are in terms of first aid out in the wild.
So true. That's exactly what we were talking about before the morning show began.
And I'll preempt one of our guests, Tom, who's nodding his head, and he'll give a plug for the Garmin Mini inReach.
Okay.
Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, right now.
Yeah, right now.
Well,
on the spot.
One of the things, and by the way, Carol Jenkins is the lady who teaches the course, does a fantastic job. And I really want to acknowledge Carol and thank her very much for doing this over the years. It's just a tremendous course. One of the things we learned is that there are lots of situations where you may have to do an evacuation. And many of our backcountry trails here in northern Idaho and throughout the rest of Idaho, particularly in our large wilderness areas, there's no cell service. So if you have to call for a rescue or an evacuation, you have to do that with some kind of a satellite communicator. And the one that I particularly endorse and is also endorsed by Outdoor Gear Lab, an evaluation service, is the Garmin inReach. And it comes in two flavors, so to speak. One is heavier. It's 7 to 8 ounces. I'm an ultralight backpacker, and so they have a mini that's 3.5 ounces. Wonderful device. You subscribe to a service, and if you need help, you can get it anywhere.
True. Now, that is not a commercial for Garmin inReach, since we're community radio, but there aren't many to choose from. Yeah. So those are kind of it.
And thank you, Tom. And we're going to turn back to our guests in a few moments. But what's always pressing on everyone's mind is the weather.
All right. But before that, Phil, I told you what you did this weekend, and you didn't share. I know your wife, Deb, was with me all weekend. What were you up to?
I had a long honey-do list. Because she was training this weekend. The payoff is chores around the house.
Well, very good.
But it has been lovely the last few evenings with the full or nearly full moon rising. It almost makes it seem like the day is longer than the 4:30 p.m. sunset. So a couple walks along the Ponte Rey Bay Trail by moonlight. What could be better?
Very nice. And the days certainly are getting shorter. And we have no moonlight to look forward to as I review the weather forecast, Phil, unfortunately. Today, oh boy, rain and snow likely, high of 37. Tomorrow, tonight, a low of 30. And it sort of goes on like that for the rest of the week. Highs in the low to mid 40s. Foggy, rainy, possibly snowy weather. Lows in the high 20s, low 30s. So if you haven't gotten out and enjoyed the Indian summer, I think you may have missed it. On with our morning show.
Well, once again, we're going to be talking about trails, but we're going to take a really specific deep dive into some of the early wilderness trail leaders in Idaho. With us today is Tom Dabrowski, who you had just heard from, a regular morning show guest as we talk about all things trails. Tom is the board chairman of the Idaho Trails Association, and we also are very privileged this morning to have author and trail advocate John McCarthy in the studio with us. Good morning, John.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me up here in North Idaho with the rain and snow and fog. It's great.
You got here just in time.
Just in time.
Yeah. Much different than the desert climate of Boise.
But well, we have sun most days, but this is the north. Yeah, that's why you have cedar trees.
So we're going to talk today. John's going to talk today about his book, his relatively new book, Working the Wilderness, Early Leaders for Wildlands. And I want to briefly introduce the book. So I'm going to take the easy way out and pretty much read what's on the back flap. About the book, Working the Wilderness, Early Leaders for Wildlands tells true stories about four men and one woman who established how to work in and be in the wilderness. They were guides for protection of wilderness and for the protectors who followed them. Their lives were immersed in service to wildlands and the American people. They worked for the U.S. Forest Service, centered in the vast Selway Bitterroot Wilderness of Idaho and Montana. Three were active before and after the Wilderness Act of 1964. The younger two came in at the beginning of the modern wilderness era. They all adapted skills of the pioneers to the new land designation. Their stories celebrate heroes for the enduring resources of wilderness and point to the future to keep their legacies thriving. And we're going to focus in on all those things, particularly that future-oriented vision, and talk, too, about how Idaho Trails helps carry that out. So John McCarthy, for those who aren't familiar, moved to Idaho in 1977 to work trail crew in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness for the Forest Service. He later ran a range crew and worked on ranches in Hell's Canyon and the Salmon River Country. After that, he began writing about wilderness as a reporter for the Lewiston Morning Tribune, where he also covered cops, courts, arts, and agriculture. After 10 years, he switched to environmental advocacy, working for 2 decades as either the conservation director for the Idaho Conservation League, and then later for the Idaho Forest Campaign as a director for the Wilderness Society. He now is on radio, Julie. He's a jazz disc jockey. We have one of our own in the room, so yep. We want to celebrate that.
Yeah, radio is still the way to go, folks.
That's right. This is going to make our interview much easier, Phil. We have one of our own.
I know. We can just turn it over. John, you can do the interview.
That's right.
So let's start a little bit with, too, why you're up here this weekend. And John, Tom?
Well, Friends of Scotchman's Peak and Idaho Trails Association has invited me to do a presentation this evening at 6 o'clock at the Utari Brewery. And I've been on the road. This will be, I think, the 12th gig I've done. I have 2 more set up this week. And I do a slideshow and talk about the book. And then I talk about the work I'm doing these days as a volunteer leader of trail crews for volunteers with Idaho Trails Association, and I've done it with the Selway Bitterroot Frank Church Foundation. So it's an opportunity to look at the past and look at the present and think about what we do next to take care of our wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a great book, and it's going to be a great presentation tonight. Is there a charge for it?
No, it's a freebie. Yeah. I mean, and there's an opportunity to drink beer, so
this
is a bonus.
What could be better?
And then the other thing is, if people come a bit early, say if you came at 5:30, we're going to have a 1930s vintage crosscut saw, Simmons crosscut saw.
Oh, nice.
It was donated to us by someone whose grandfather had it in the barn. It was never used in the woods before it was donated to us. We call it our show saw. So we're going to have that there tonight with a log, and so people can come out and have some fun with a crosscut saw.
And this is a case, actually, saws are a case where older is better.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot about that technology that's been lost, like we no longer make that kind of steel.
So we'll be lucky to see that one and use it, possibly. John, before we get into talking about the book, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself? How did you find your passion for wilderness?
Well, I'd always been interested in the outdoors and always been interested in nature. You know, just my mother introduced me to nature in many, many different ways. We did a great Western trip. I grew up in New York and Cape Cod, and we did a great Western trip that took us to all the national parks when I was 9 years old. And that really stuck with me. I mean, going to Yosemite and Yellowstone and Grand Canyon and going to the coast of California really, really stuck with me. And so I came back when I was able to get out on my own after high school and came back multiple times and ended up staying in the early 70s when I was in my early 20s. And I was a carpenter in those days and looking for a way to be in the wilderness or looking for a way to be in the national parks. And trails is fit in with my interest in being practical and doing things, not just talking to people or not being on a fire lookout where you're stuck. You're not moving around, but you're out on the trail.
So how did you land in Idaho?
I was in Utah because there was lots of construction work, and I made friends at Utah State University, went to school for a little while, realized that my math handicap was not going to allow me to become a forester. But I had a lot of friends in forestry college, wildlife biology, and they all worked for the Forest Service in the summer. Mm-hmm. And they told me about this incredible, great place, the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, and these incredible, great people, Emil and Penny Keck. And so it was both a combination of an opportunity to learn from masters and to be in the wildest place of America.
And I think living here in Idaho, we don't have to preach the gospel to our listeners. We know how special it is. At least we know how special North Idaho is. Sometimes we forget that there is this vast wilderness south of us. Tell us a little bit about what makes the place so special and so challenging to do the work in that you've done and that ITA is currently doing.
Well, part of the beauty is that it's so big, it's empty. It's really hard to get in the middle of it. And I was in the middle. Moose Creek Ranger Station is where the base has been since the 50s, when airplanes were the supply train, and they were no longer working as much with pack trains. And being in the middle where there was an airstrip meant that we could get resupplied by bigger planes, but we also had access to the whole vast area. And it's always been really real wild place. Pretty much most of it doesn't get seen by people except for during hunting season. And that was definitely the story in the 70s, and it's still the story today. And it's just an opportunity to be in a place where you really don't see people for as days and days at a time. And often when we were out on the trail, the people we'd run into were the people we worked with. And there'd be the Wilderness Rangers coming by or the Packers coming by. And I was there from April until almost Christmas, and the first year and the second year from April until October. And to be out there where you're self-reliant and being on your own was just a great experience for a young person to learn how to be on your own and to not, you know, today we're tied into so much stuff. Well, none of that stuff reaches out there. We were talking earlier about how there's no cell coverage. There's no cell coverage for a long, long ways out there. And there's never going to be. And we're never going to have cell towers. And that's just, it's a way to be back in the old lands.
So we're talking about a vast wilderness with trails that become overgrown over time, and not very many people access them other than maybe the trail workers. Why is it important, Tom, maybe, or John? Why should we maintain these trails?
Well, first we have to recognize how incredibly fortunate we are here in Idaho. I mean, we do have these absolutely fantastic lands. And the reason that it's important to get back in those remote areas is if we don't maintain those trails, they'll be abandoned and we'll never get them back. I guess it's fair to say that because of the federal bureaucracy, if a trail is officially abandoned, the chances of getting that trail back are slim to none. So what we did for the first time this year, the Idaho Trails Association is 9 years old. This year we had 3 fly-in projects to the middle of these remote wilderness areas. And we got back there so we can maintain those trails. As John said, back when he was back in there, he never saw anyone. But one of the things we've noticed in modern years, some of the wilderness areas are just overrun with hikers today. Take Sawtooths, for example. It's really difficult to find a place where you won't be overrun with lots of other hikers. So we're going back into these very remote areas. We provide our volunteers with a great opportunity to get in a remote area that few have seen, maintain those trails, because I firmly believe that, unfortunately, 20 years from now, there will be a lot of people back there. So we want to have as many trails as we can.
And you each have touched on something that is unique about the area, the airstrips, the backcountry airstrips, which exist because of the remoteness, the depth of the remoteness. There's only a few places, a handful, I think 3 or 4 in the lower 48, where you can be more than 20 miles away from the nearest road. And so those airstrips were built in the era before wilderness designation and were grandfathered in by the Wilderness Act and really provided a unique access point.
Yes, and so they provide us a great access point, because one of the places we went to this year, it was over 30 miles from the closest passable road to get back to where we worked. Well, if you have to hike 30 miles in and 30 miles out carrying all your tools and all your gear, you don't have a whole lot of time left in a week to get much done.
Yeah, by the time you get there, you get a couple trees. One of the other things, and John, you write very well about this in your book, are the unique challenges and opportunities posed by the water. This is a wet wilderness, and the bridges that needed to be built by hand and repaired and maintained by hand, that's an increasingly lost art.
Yeah, the bridge that I write about that Emil and Penny Keck rebuilt in 1969, Bear Creek Bridge, they rebuilt it, the two of them, every stick, just the two of them, through 2 winters. That bridge was closed for almost 2 years because the caps rotted out, which happens, it's wood, and they didn't have the, it, the money and the crews to do it. But the good news is they did get it done at the end of this year. So it's reopened. Bear Creek is almost impassable in the spring. And the reason these are lower elevation bridges across the Selway River or across Three Links or across Moose Creek. And the main trail on the Selways opened in April. But by the time that the real flush hits in May and June, it's warming up and there can be fires. And people, you know, in July, still the rivers are high, the creeks are high, it's still melting off the snow, but there can be fires. And all of these trails and bridges were built for firefighting back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. None of these trails were built for recreation, but they have the added opportunity for recreation. And the hunters used them starting in the back in the teens, back in the 20s, and this, we're talking 1920s. And it's opened up this country so people can see it and can appreciate it. And back to the thing about why do we do these trails, it's so people can appreciate it and mm-hmm. so people can have the experience. And I mean, I say how there's hardly anybody out there, but I still spend a lot of time. And depending on the time of year, there are quite a few people on. I was on the main Selway this summer with my grandchildren, who were 10 and 12, and it was their first time out there, and we went backpacking, and it was wonderful for them, and they've got the bug. But it was, you know, in August, there's quite a few people. In May, I go, and you see a few bear hunters, and it's one thing that's really cool is that you see young people out there, mm-hmm. you know, people in their 20s, people in their 30s, and they're out there experiencing it, and it's there for them now, just like it was for us when we were back in the day when we were all young.
Back when our knees still worked okay.
Yeah, and we could get out and take carry big packs. And
that's right.
You know.
And if I may, speaking about young people, one of the other things we did for the first time this year in the Idaho Trails Association is we had three youth projects. The whole idea here is to get our young people out, to get them to appreciate our wild country, our public lands. And I'm going to read a simple sentence. This came from a young lady. This was her first time out in her public lands. She said, "This experience is one that I will remember and cherish for the rest of my life."
True.
From Gracie. And that what we want to do is get more of our young people to get out there and realize how incredibly special these public lands are.
So it's a special place, and our public lands are a wonderful asset. Let's turn to how, John, you cover them in the book, and you profile these individuals. Tell us a little bit more about why you chose the people you chose to profile.
Well, all of these, the folks, the five lead characters, are incredibly skilled in being able to be in the wilderness and do the work that needs to be done, whether it's work with people, the visitors, or work directly on the land to maintain the bridges, to maintain the trails, to maintain the base stations, the ranger stations. They were all incredibly skilled, but they were also all teachers. They were all people who wanted to share their ideas, their information, their skills, and teach other people how to do the work. And so when I got to thinking about how could I characterize what I learned and what really mattered, I figured the best way to do it was focus on short biographies of each of these individuals. And they came from very different backgrounds, but then there was some real similarities in their backgrounds, except for perhaps Warren Miller, that master saw filer and the master of the crosscut saw. He was more of a geek. The others were more of on the land people in their upbringing.
So to clarify, this is not the Warren Miller of ski movies.
No, this is Warren Q. Miller.
All right.
And Warren was, and he was the closest to being my contemporary. The others are a half a generation or a full generation older than me. And three of them dated back to the old days when one was a mountain man, one was a logger with a crosscut saw, one was a ranch hand in the old days.
So tell us a little bit about each, a thumbnail sketch of each of them.
Emil and Penny Keck, they were my bosses. They ran the trail program and had previously done the firework, but the firework had gotten so complicated. And I touch on that with Bud Moore, the next character. But Emil was a logger from his youth and then was a firefighter and then ended up in Moose Creek in 1963 and stayed for 25 years. Penny came out as a young woman, as a lookout, grew up on a farm and really knew how to work as a farm kid in near Portland, small farm, but, you know, real hands-on place. And she just latched on to the work. And somehow Penny and Emil latched on to each other.
It's a love story.
It's a crazy love story. And I wish I could have gotten more of it because... But they just wouldn't talk about it.
I think you captured it nicely.
Okay. I had a good time trying to rethink it and recreate it. But there's 30 years difference. And Emil lost his first wife to cancer when they were living out of Moose Creek. Anyway, it's a long, wonderful story of how they met and how they hooked up. And then they stayed together and did the work, the two of them. And the cool thing was, is that as much as they were just out on their own and they didn't deal with people most of the year or half the year. The other half of the year, they dealt with us young people and taught us how to do the work. And they were just such solid teachers. And they just were so dedicated to people being safe and serious and getting the work done. And that ethic carried through all of our lives.
And then the legendary Bud Moore. It's hard to sum him up in a few words, but try.
Well, Bud Moore was a mountain man, and he grew up on the east side of the Selway Bitterroot in Lolo Creek, and he would watch the mountain men go past his family's homestead and say, that's what I want to do. At age 13, he was out herding sheep in the wilderness. He was running a trap line in the winter as a teenager. He gave up going to school, and he was totally self-taught mountain man and was a trapper, a firefighter, and worked his way up to be district ranger at Powell, there along the Locksaw on the north side of the Selway, and worked his way up to be the head of fire for Region 1. And Region 1 has always had a lot of fire, and it's always been one of the leaders in fire control. And he figured out how to do fire management. And so his whole story hadn't really been told about the fire part. Mm-hmm. And so I, through interviews, at that time Bud was gone, and I went back and did interviews with people who worked with him to tell the story of how he had managed fire, monitored fire, not always fire control, so there would be more than natural conditions. And one of the people one of the few people who were higher up who supported him was a guy named Bill Wharf, also from Montana, grew up on a farm in eastern, on a ranch in eastern Montana, out in the plains. And his interest was in horses and in being in the backcountry. And he was one of the people who was tapped to go back to Washington, D.C. in 1964, after the Wilderness Act passed, to write the regulations, to write the concepts, to write out how we deal with wilderness. And they called it wilderness management in those days. Now we call it wilderness stewardship. And I think the concept of stewardship is really more fitting, because you don't really manage the wilderness, you manage people. And you're a steward of the land. Mm-hmm. And those concepts were really developed by Bill Wharf and others, but Wharf really carried it. And Wharf was really supportive of field workers. So there were skilled people out there doing the work. And all through his career, he tried to see that the young people were learning the skills from the masters. And so he was tremendously supportive of Emil and Penny. And one of those guys who, the fifth character was one of the guys who got out there in the early 70s, 1970, and stayed and hooked up with Emil and Penny. And Emil knew how to run a crosscut saw. Mm-hmm. And he taught Warren Q. Miller how to run a crosscut saw. But to really work a saw, you have to keep it sharp. You have to keep it, you know, fix anything that breaks. You have to find good saws and refurbish them, because it'd been 20, 30 years since the chainsaw was in, and the chainsaw bumped the crosscut saw as soon as it came in. But in the wilderness, where you can't use motorized equipment, the crosscut saw was brought back. And Warren was the guy who really figured out what the saw was all about. And then again, taught people to do what he did, which was sharpen saws, repair saws, refurbish saws, fine saws. And hit that whole ethic of the saw is the preferred tool is really because of Warren, because he knew how to do it.
It's such a nice collection of stories that integrate really well into some of the challenges, unique opportunities, and resources that wilderness provide. Do you have a reading you'd like to share with us? Authors always
okay,
have that.
Okay. All right. So I've already, in the book, I've already introduced Emil and Penny. But I'm going to start for a piece that just gives you a little taste of how their life was. When Emil and Penny Keck worked at both the Three Links and Bear Creek Bridge sites, they set up a base camp to stay for months that led to years of living out of a 10 by 20 foot canvas wall tent, same as the first construction camps in the backcountry. A scrap of plywood nailed to a stump made a table. Bolts of wood set on end made stools. Canvas mantis laid over the dirt formed a floor. Panniers and old powder boxes became shelves. Most food was freeze-dried, dry goods, or canned, all cooked on a wood stove. A hole dug under the floor and lined with boughs created a root cellar with a plywood cap. The cool storage not only kept cans from freezing, they layered in fruits, cabbages, and root vegetables. A Coleman lantern hung from the ridgepole for light in the long winter nights and early mornings. They packed in a metal bed frame to Three Links to keep off the ground above the rattlesnakes. A crackly transistor radio to listen to baseball games with a number 9 wire running up into the trees for an antenna offered the only thing in the tent that resembled a luxury and the only connection with the outside world. How much more?
You want to wow.
Keep going?
That's nice. We'll okay. Have another reading in a bit. And
okay.
For those who are just tuning in, this is KRFY. 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. And this morning we're talking about, once again, trails, but we have the great pleasure to have John McCarthy, author of Working the Wilderness, as well as Tom Dabrowski from Idaho Trails Association. And I think we'll take a short music break now. And this is the day in 1944 when Booker T of Booker T and the MGs was born. So we're going to listen to one of his classics. John, do you want to introduce it?
Booker T and the MGs?
Yes.
With the MGs?
Yeah.
Booker T and the MGs.
And that was Green Onions with Booker T and the MGs. If you're just joining us, this is KRFY listener-supported community radio for the Idaho Panhandle. This is Julie Calamine, and I'm here with Phil Huff. We're having a great morning show this morning. Planning for an upcoming event, talking about an upcoming event tonight that's going to be readings and introduction of author John McCarthy, who is with us this morning, and it's hosted by Friends of Scotchman Peak Wilderness and also Idaho Trails Association. And for that reason, we also have Tom Dabrowski with us this morning.
And so the centerpiece here is the book that John McCarthy has just released in this last year, Working the Wilderness. It's a fabulous book if you're interested at all in trails or wilderness or even just a great biography or, as we touched on, a love story. This book has it all, John. Yeah, you packed a lot in.
Yeah, thanks.
And you've packed a lot into your career, and your whole career has really come to inform your ability and interest as a writer, and we've explored a little bit of the early days, what brought you to Idaho, the trail work, and your experiences there. Tell us how you moved to and became a reporter in Lewiston.
Boy. I stayed doing backcountry stuff for a couple of years, even after I left Moose Creek and left us working for the Forest Service, worked on ranches and worked for the Forest Service again. But then I had a kid and life was catching up and I was getting older and I thought, you know, actually I might want to find a job that I could really do for a long time. And if I wasn't going to be working for the Forest Service, I could be writing about the land I cared about and the places I cared about. And, if you're young and you want to have a living, make a living as a writer, the best thing to do is be in newspapers. And I went back to school and also immediately started stringing for what was then the Idahonian, it's now the Daily News in Moscow and Pullman, but it was then the Idahonian in Moscow, and was a full-time student and a stringer, and then became a full-time reporter while I was still a student and trying to finish. And my goal was always to be an outdoor writer, but life doesn't always work out that way. Reporter we had, Bill Loftus, who did outdoors and environment there at the Tribune, he was pretty protective of his turf, but I still got a chance to write a bunch of stories about the backcountry and the people I knew. And so I did a lot of profiles and started writing about the people I knew in the backcountry and thought that I could make a book out of it. And again, life got ahead of me and the book didn't get completed, but I had a set of interviews from back in the 80s over time, multiple times with Emil and Penny Keck, multiple times with Bud Moore, and tracked Bill Wharf in many different ways. And the book didn't get written back then, But I continued to write, and even as I switched from being a newspaper reporter after 10 years to being an advocate, I still, you know, that what we do is in organizing people to care about these places, we introduce it to them by photos. Now, I think probably video is a much bigger deal, but we introduce it through photos and through stories. And that was my interest, was in getting people to know about these places, these wildlands.
So what sparked and how did you make the move from writing about a variety of topics to becoming the conservation director at Idaho Conservation League?
The thing about being a newspaper reporter that translates really well into being a conservation organizer is trying to introduce people to ideas through stories and what really makes people understand why these lands are important is to understand the past and why it matters today. And that is by introducing people, if you can't take them out there, like Tom was saying, I mean, the best thing to do is to take them out there and to show them the lands, and everybody gets it. I mean, anybody of any age who has the opportunity to be out on a trail goes, I want to come back. I want to know about how to be here. But if they can't get out there, or if it's winter, people still want to read about it. They want to see pictures. They want to know about these lands. They want to know about the scientists who are out there. They want to know about the people who do the physical work. They want to know about hunters and guides and floaters and all the different aspects of our American wildland heritage is alive today, and people want to know about it. So the skills as a reporter and also being able to just call people up and ask questions and ask them to do things, that's a transferable skill as well. And as a reporter, you get to know a lot of people. And so I knew a lot of people. I mean, I'd met senators and interviewed senators and governors. And so I was not afraid to go to Washington, D.C. and talk to governors and senators and, you know, do the things you do as an advocate. So that's, I mean, and I was recruited by board member. Board members are pretty good in these organizations.
And so then after working at Idaho Conservation League, you moved over to the Wilderness Society, still in Boise, probably covering a lot of the same topics and stories.
Yeah, and in that case, when I switched to a program that was about restoration forestry, and it sort of brought me back full circle to being interested in really intensive land management. But in this case, it was really for restoration post-logging boom. I mean, I spent a bunch of years trying to slow down the logging machine, and it did get slowed down because we just were running out of the old growth, and we were messing up the roads, we're messing up the watershed, and everybody understood it, including the loggers understood it. And the clear-cut era was really not beneficial in the long run, and people understood it. But that phase, one of the 7 years I worked for the Wilderness Society, wasn't so much advocating for land protection. It was advocating for good conservation practices and land restoration. And that, again, brought me into being able to deal with collaborative groups and having lived in Grangeville for a bunch of years.
And really, that in that time, in that position, you were at the forefront of what we now accept as a common practice, collaboration. In terms of multiple stakeholders and others who are interested in the issues of forest management. Tell us a little bit about starting those processes.
Well, interestingly, the one we got started was called Stewards of the Nez Perce Forest. That was the very first one, and it was back in Grangeville. And I went back. Grangeville is where I worked out of when I worked at Moose Creek in the Nez Perce National Forest. It's the headquarters. And in that group, we had loggers, but we also had the guy who ran the machine shop, real practical guy that I knew from back in the day because he made us equipment. And that sense of hardworking people of Idaho and the people who really know the land, and then folks who want to see the land protected, figured out how to work together. And it was a really great process. And in a sense, that gave, and it was real struggle, of course, but I would do, it's a 4-hour drive from Boise, and I'd do it to go up to these meetings all the time and come out of them going, man, this is going to work. We want to work together. That's the point. And we want to see that it be good for the land. We want to see that it's good for the local communities. And we had a whole cross-section. We had folks from the Nez Perce tribe. We had a whole cross-section of folks who worked together. And I think in many ways, it was a sense of timing that everybody could see that overdid it with the logging boom, with the industrialization of the forest. We overdid it. And now, how do we rebuild the roads and have a functioning road system? How do we, and man, I'm driving up here looking at the log decks. It worked. We're back in business. And I've been out of the game of the intensity that I had for many years. So I can't tell you for sure it's all being done right. But I think it, from what I'm hearing, there's a much greater care that you know, people want to do it right. Mm-hmm. These are hardworking folks.
Well, there it is. People from very disparate backgrounds working together and seeing some successful results. That's inspiring. It really is.
I you know, there was a time when I'd be spooked by driving past the log decks. But now I drive past the log decks and they're small logs. Mm-hmm. They're taking out the small trees. They're not taking out the big old growth. You know, the old growth is protected. And I also know that they're rebuilding roads. And that, but that sense of that the community can work together, I think, is the biggest important lesson.
And I think that lesson also comes into inform the almost full circle that you're continuing to make, or continue to make in 2010, as being one of the folks who really helped to form and shape the early days of the Idaho Trails Association. And I want to touch on that a little bit, acknowledging there were a number of people involved, but John, you were in some ways one of the key elements of that, in that you got the first projects out and running.
Yeah, and it was also based on how do we get people really appreciate these lands, and how do we get people out there doing the work, and also how to rebuild support for the professionals, for the Forest Service. As the Forest Service overdid it with the industrial logging, they got beat up by a lot of different forces, and fire was increasing, and the Forest Service was just not able to cover the land like they used to do back in the day when I was out there, and we had three crews, often four crews, in the backcountry. On this Moose Creek Ranger District, 500,000-acre ranger district, now just weren't able to cover the ground. And we needed more people out there, not only to do the physical work, but to understand the importance of the work. So it was both advocacy, and that the very early concept was that we were going to advocate for non-motorized trails, we're going to advocate for wilderness trails, we're going to advocate for the backcountry, and we're going to get people out there doing the work.
In that first year, 2010, I think there was two projects. One, Tom's showing me one. Yes, the archives historically show that. And a pretty rapid progression after that. So we're here 9 years later. Tom, tell us about this last summer.
Well, this year we had 36 projects. All around the state of Idaho, we had 277 different volunteers from all over the state and some adjoining state. In fact, we had some people come from quite far away, and the folks ranged all the way from like 8 years old to over 75 years old out there working on trails. And one of the things we talk about is happy, smiling faces. And we see lots of people that go out there and have a great time. And I had read that quote from the young lady, Gracie, a little while ago. And we have feedback from people, and they say the thing they enjoyed more than anything else was the camaraderie. Meetings, folks with similar views, similar mindsets. Now, the other thing that's very interesting, we have a lot of professional people that say that their job involves projects they work on for 2 or 3 years. And so they just grind along. And I tell them, come on out. In one day, you'll see you got something done.
Yeah.
And so we really enjoy those before and after pictures. I'm a volunteer, and I just happen to be president of the board. And I've just had a tremendous amount of fun. And I know that Julie's volunteered on projects, and Phil, you have as well. Yep. And John, you have as well. So we're all out there, and I think all of us have had a really good time doing this. And at the end of the day, you realize you got something done, it was something good, and you're really kind of paying it forward. So our future generations will have trails that we were able to enjoy.
It's fun, and it's satisfying. Mm-hmm. And if we have listeners who have not participated in a trail project before, and want to find out more how, they can come to the event tonight.
They can come tonight at 5:30 to 6 o'clock at Utera and on Pine Street, 214 Pine Street, I think it is.
That's the old Rapid Lightning Lube.
Mm-hmm. But it's much more pleasant now. In any case, come on out tonight. And if you can't do that, you can go to IdahoTrailsAssociation.org or you can go to Facebook, which some people have now got me involved with. But in any case, just Idaho Trails Association.
Yeah, the earth did shift just a little bit on its axis a couple weeks ago when mm-hmm. Tom Dabrowski showed up on Facebook. My first thought was it's a spammer.
Mm-hmm. But well, unfortunately, it was me.
Yeah. So, John, you're... career arc then, starting off working in the wilderness, writing about it for the Lewiston Tribune, advocating for it with Idaho Conservation League, finding common ground with the Wilderness Society, helping to form Idaho Trails Association, and finally back to the book. All of that comes into play in informing your writing.
Yeah, and that whole, I mean, I think the writing, again, is... I mean, I'm trying to celebrate these great characters that I knew who were just, you know, really interesting people. And Emil Keck was the funniest person on the planet. And so I'm trying to celebrate them. But I also want people to appreciate these what they taught us. And I want people to appreciate the opportunity to go out and do it themselves. So the last chapter, I talk about where we are today. And one of the points is we need the pros like we were. And we need the young people and we need to pay them. But we also need volunteers, and it's the volunteers is both, as Tom was saying, to have that sense of accomplishment and connection, but also to just support the whole idea of wilderness and the whole idea that it's up to us. When we, you know, wilderness is now more than 50 years old. It took a long time to put the Wilderness Act through, and it's up to us to see that it sustains. And the whole concept of wilderness, that there's some place that doesn't change much. It changed because of natural forces and a little bit of the work we do to connect it with the trails and the bridges. But there's some place that stays like the West always was, or like, in, you know, and even the little wildernesses in the East, it's like the land of America always was. That concept is as viable today as it was 50 years ago. It's going to be as viable 50 years from now because we're going to have protected a piece of land is the land comes first. Well, and so writing about it for me was another opportunity to take the lessons from the masters and who were great teachers and maybe do a little teaching today.
So do you have another reading for us?
Sure. I'll continue with that that bit because I think the idea of Emil and Penny lived there all year round. They didn't leave. They're the only people that lived there all year round then. Nobody lives there all year round now. But the key to winter camp comfort was a Kimball wood stove, deceptive in its simplicity. The bottomless stove sat directly on sand with a space cut out from the canvas floor. A double layer of sheet plastic formed an envelope that encircled both the floor and over the peak of the roof. The plastic shed rain and slicked off snow from the roof while trapping the warmth of the stove. As Emil explained, the box stove warmed up the sand floor so pretty quick it gets so gosh darned hot that you could walk around barefoot when it's 40 below if you wanted to. That sure was a nice way to live. So when anyone felt sorry for us for staying in a winter camp, we're as warm as can be.
That's well said, well said.
He didn't say gosh.
and for more, including some photos, slides, folks can come out tonight.
Yeah, and some of them are my pictures, and I collected pictures from my friends, and one guy in particular, Dick Walker, was a historian photographer. And
I'll bet we can get the book tonight if we'd
yes,
like it.
Yes, I'll have copies of the book, and I'd be happy to sign a copy that anybody has.
Very nice. Well, John, we can't let you go without touching on your interest in community radio. We understand that you're a DJ at a station in Boise. Tell us about that.
Yep. Wednesday mornings, Radio Boise, KRBX 89.9 FM, Caldwell, Boise.
Oh, boy. Can we live stream?
You can live stream it. Wednesday from 9 to noon, I do Jazz Beyond the Sky. It's a dedicated jazz show. Radio Boise, like KRFY, is eclectic. We have all different kinds of music, and we have some public affairs. We have some interview shows. I'm the only dedicated jazz DJ, and it's mostly music that is new. It's mostly the music
new
of today.
New jazz.
Yep. We're going to have to get you in touch with our jazz DJ, John Royhans, who plays weekly. He's our live jazz DJ.
He sometimes comes out. If he's there tonight, we'll make sure to introduce you.
Yeah. We'll encourage him to come tonight.
Put me in touch. Yeah, I really like radio for all the reasons that it's immediate and it's direct. And I really like community radio because it reflects where we live and gives people an opportunity to have a voice.
Mm-hmm. Local information going out to the community and independent.
And it's very good. It's from that specific community. And, you know, sure, we also do Amy Goodman. We also do Democracy Now. And we just probably share some other shows. But most of what we do here in community radio is our town.
We give voices to those who wouldn't have a voice otherwise.
That's for real. So, for real.
John, welcome. Thank you for coming on the show. It's been a
real
pleasure.
It's really nice to be here. It's nice to be in a radio show.
As always, good to see you come out tonight.
Absolutely. Yes, please come on out tonight. And John will do some readings, show some slides, and visit. And so
maybe pull us off.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go. You're gonna get a chance to pull a 1930s saw, and it is razor sharp. It's a joy to run.
And Tom, I have a feeling you won't be given the instruction because those of you who can't see Tom Dabrowski don't know that he's in an arm sling. So I don't think you're going to be instructing
tonight. He's handicapped in the competition.
As you well know, Julie, I won't be quiet.
That's
so
true.
So I'll be there to provide verbal coaching.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this morning. Once again, please make it out to Utara tonight, folks, and have an opportunity to meet John McCarthy and purchase a book. You'll get an autographed one and have a few beers. I'll do my best to make it as well. This is KRFY, community-supported radio for the Idaho Panhandle, and we're going to take a song break and be back with some upcoming events. In honor of Neil Young's birthday, we're going to be hearing